2%.
The 2%'s right over here.
Oh, hey, Jenna. I didn't know you shopped here.
Yeah. Anything to support local food, know what I mean?
I definitely do. Though that's not the only thing you do in the name of Good Eats, obviously.
Well, true. I also host Eating Matters every Wednesday at 5 p.m., where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. Be sure to tune in.
All right, gotta get the plug in there. I get it.
Yep, I'm hashtag shameless.
You know what else you can do to support the local food community, right?
Well, yeah. Make a donation to Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station.
That's right. And I gotta call you out on the whole local thing.
What do you mean?
Well, The Farm Report, A Taste of the Past, Japan Eats. Those are shows that take you around the country and the world.
I'll give you that. So how can listeners give their support?
It's pretty easy. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the big red heart in the top right corner. It's pretty easy from there.
Thanks.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey guys, it's Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So it's June 12th. It's a beautiful sunny day in Brooklyn here at Heritage Radio Network's headquarters at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. However, I think it would be stupid to pretend that it's not an extremely horrific day in the U.S. I'm extremely distracted today, actually, because like most of us, I woke up to just about the worst news I think I've ever seen. It's not funny. Last night there was the worst mass shooting in U.S. history in Miami at a nightclub, a gay nightclub. And, we're feeling the loss of 50 people there, and, some 50, some others were wounded. And it's really rough. So how do you, go on with your day? I'm sure there'll be much to get angry about and much frustration to vent about, some of this really criminal negligence on behalf of some of our politicians. I would say criminal manipulation on behalf of certain industry groups. But for the meantime, it's just a really sad day in our history. And maybe it's a turning point, I hope, but we'll see. I have a wonderful guest on the show today. I've actually been waiting, looking forward to having this guy on the show for like a year. And I'm actually really glad that we're not talking about like a sandwich book right now or something like a gluten-free or something. Instead, I got a wonderful novelist whose first novel is called The Kitchens of the Great Midwest. It has been hailed as a really innovative novel, and it's been quoted as a big-hearted, funny, and class-transcending pleasure, and a structural and empathetic tour de force. So the author is J. Ryan Straddle, and I've got him on the line right now. Jay, how are you? Or J. Ryan.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad you brought up the news of the day, because I'm pretty sad.
Yeah, and I know that you're on a really busy tour right now, too. So you've been traveling for the paperback publication of this book. Talk after talk at bookstore. So I imagine you are dealing with,
pretty tired, too. But I'm hanging in there. It's a, it's a good problem to have. Today's a three-city day. I woke up today in San Antonio, and right now I'm in St. Louis, and I'll end the day in Minneapolis.
Wow. I'm curious, are you going to address the tragedy at all in some of your bookstore talks or meet and greets?
I after I get off the phone with you today, I'll think about how to do that. Mm-hmm. 'Cause certainly whenever people get in public, you know, for any reason, you know, it's hard to ignore what's on our minds. And and I think talking about tragedies like what happened in Orlando amongst each other in person is really important. And not just, you know, being at home on your computer, on your phone and retweeting, you know, but actually going out and talking to people face to face is pretty, pretty crucial. So I probably will. Yes.
Yeah, and imagine it's a hard challenge, but it's also, I feel like there's a, especially from a novelist, do you feel a responsibility to kind of be really real in front of, you know, your fans and, you know, because people are reading your work and they want to get to know you and you got to represent, you know, who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, as you implied earlier, there's a show must go on element to every other aspect of life and all of our lives. That, and yeah, and I do have an obligation to the people who, you know, been waiting to meet me who read my book and want to talk with me about that. So, yeah, it's just, you know, in days like this, it's, you know, it's unfortunate we live in, you know, a country where we have to consistently find that balance between, you know, getting on with our lives in a constructive way and balancing that against how we really feel in a moment like this.
Absolutely. I really appreciate your sharing that. You know, I actually, I mean, sort of going on that tangent, as a novelist, do you feel like it's part of your work or part of your goal to reflect the times and the challenges and the most important issues of our time? Is that something that you try to do in your work as a writer?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. All the time. All the time I think about what I'm writing as it relates to what I want to see in the world or areas I see of improvement.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes it's more, you know, it's obviously more lighthearted. Like a lot of the content of Kitchens of the Great Midwest was simply about how I've seen the, you know, our relationship to food evolve over the last 30 years. But I certainly get into, you know, issues of class in particular in that book, and I think as well in my next book as well, in terms of seeing just how people are living as it relates to what they eat. You know, what can people afford to eat? What do people have access to? I mean, I think about that kind of thing all the time. I mean, I volunteer with kids in Los Angeles, and I have for 11 years, and, you know, I think a lot about what they, you know, as I drive to their public schools, I take a look at what stores, you know, restaurants, liquor shops, grocery stores are in the proximity of their schools and just what they have, the kind of food they have access to on foot or by bicycle vis-a-vis, you know, what the more privileged parts of Los Angeles have. I look at that every day. But in terms of my writing, I think about, the issues that affect me. I mean, I will have to say that I try not to be a dogmatic writer. I try not to sit down and have an argument and sit down. I'm going to sit down and attempt to tell my reader that, here, I've got something you should believe in, or I'm going to try to convince you of something. Right. Rather, I sit down with questions, and I try to figure out solutions or unpack the complexities behind the questions through fictional characters, by maybe having fictional characters occupy some corner of a dilemma that's been puzzling me.
Yeah, I don't think that your book is dogmatic at all. and nothing nothing against that. I mean, we've had plenty of dogmatic books on this show, and bring it on. I love it. But
I imagine you do have quite a few guests who have really strong opinions one way or another.
We're having Joel Salatin coming up here soon. Yeah, it'll be great. So that's really interesting. I'm curious what your relationship is with food. You know, you're not a chef. Like your main character, Eva Thorvald, becomes in this book. And so just a little background for those who haven't read it, this book sort of circles around her life in a really interesting way, going through different characters, or perspectives. And she, you know, is raised from very humble beginnings to become a really acclaimed chef in the Midwest. So, so you're not a chef. How did you decide to choose this, this focus?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for it. One of the main reasons, and one that keeps coming up also when people ask me why a female chef, is that the two chefs I know the best And two of my best friends are women named Patty Clark and Amy Schabert Kovacs, and I thought about them a lot when writing the book. I pestered them for information. I stayed over at Amy's house and woke up with her in the morning and watched her make the breakfast for her family, and also watched her work on cakes and baked goods for clients. She's a baker.
Wow.
And talk about how her job has evolved. Mm-hmm. You know, she's my age. I mean, I'm 40, and it's the job of a baker has become a lot more complex. They've had to become a lot more versatile as their customer base has evolved into what we know now, like a vegan cupcakes, gluten-free desserts across the board, and that's just the tip of it. Aside from that, also an emphasis on local provenance, using things in season, and so especially in a place like Minnesota where it's changed so much. I mean, I don't know if you've been to Minneapolis lately, but it's got a really wonderful restaurant and farmers market environment. But boy, the Minnesota I was born in 1975 is quite different from the one I see now in a lot of those ways. And so I really set out to write a book that sets a track that evolution, through concentrating on one character, who embodied that evolution, who was born in Minnesota in the late 80s and becomes a pop-up supper club magnet.
Right.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, there has been a sort of gourmet or restaurant boom throughout most U.S. cities, I think, in the last couple of decades. And this book was actually exotic to me because I'm from the East Coast and I don't really know much about Midwest. So, about lutefisk to the various different bars that, I thought bars was a place where you go to drink, but little did I know. It's a huge source of pride from the Midwest. It was actually really fascinating. And, this book is being also described as a sort of love note to the foods of the Midwest that you capture throughout, evolving throughout time. So I thought that was really wonderful, because I don't know if this is like sort of also in response to this, but I mean, and I apologize, but my understanding of Midwestern food was like casseroles and not so great food, not too good stuff.
I
don't know.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Comfort food and, combinations of meat and dairy in different proportions, sometimes
cheese.
Jello and various vegetables and fruits and dairy. And that was very much the world I was born into and grew up in. And I think that's still it. Like when I think of a typical Minnesota dish, I still think of things like tater tot hot dish. Things where cream mushroom soup is an ingredient. I was talking with someone yesterday and I said I couldn't remember ever having cream of mushroom soup. Like, we had around the house to add to things. Same with Lipton onion soup mix. I've never had Lipton onion soup in my life, and nor do I know anyone who's had it. It's an ingredient.
That's really funny. Well, so the first chapter, and each chapter, I love this, centers around a different food. So there's sweet pepper jelly. There's the bars that we talked about. And the first one, I really was intrigued by it. It's lutefisk. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Oh, yeah, sure. But, the Swedes sometimes say lutefisk. They leave out the E.
Lutefisk?
At least the Swedish cookbook I have at home leaves out the E. And I think Norwegians are more likely to call it lutefisk, but who knows? I'd say it's a little subjective, but for the purposes of this, I was dealing with a Norwegian lutefisk maker, and as was my great grandfather, he was Norwegian. He called it lutefisk, so I'm sticking to that story. Mm-hmm. And it's disgusting. I'm not a fan. Out of all the types of food research I did for this book, that was the one I can honestly call unpleasant. I think I describe it in the book as looking like jellied smog and smelling like boiled aquarium water. And that's not...
Yeah, at one point you said it was snot-colored like whitefish or something.
Lye is involved. It's treated with lye. A family member told me that lutefisk came to be so the Norwegians would have something to eat in the winter that right. the dogs wouldn't eat.
Right.
You know.
Well, I'm wondering now because preservation and, you know, traditional methods of preserving just about everything is coming back in a big way in the food scene. So I'm wondering if lutefisk is making a comeback.
Maybe. I wouldn't mind seeing some, you know, modern artisanal lutefisk. There was a Mexican-American chef in Chicago who hosted a pop-up supper club based on my book, and he made a run at lutefisk that was the best lutefisk I've ever had.
He made it himself?
But it was a modern variant on it. It wasn't the traditional, you know, jellied pond scum. but, yeah, it was...
It's one of those great
culinary tradition specific to a certain culture that becomes kind of part and parcel of enforcement of that culture. I mean, a lot of cultures have something like this, have some sort of disgusting food that usually doesn't leave, you know, the confines of that that culture's table, you know. But so I don't think lutefisk is going to catch on too much, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, I'm very intrigued. I would like to try this. And I loved how, you know, your character in the beginning of the book, Lars, chef, he describes it as when he actually tries to, he purchases this as a grown up. His parents made him work in the lutefisk, you know, helping out, you know, to manufacture this stuff. And he hated it from then and then never looked, you know, back at it until later on he buys it for a Christmas dinner that he's hoping to kind of bring it out as a sort of joke. It was very touching. And, you know, I don't want to give away too much about the book, but he never quite does that. And I'm always sort of mournful for that. I'm curious, you know, to see what would happen if, you know, somebody who hated with a passion this fish, you know, tried it again much later and what the experience would be like. Yeah, that's just one moment. There's so many moments throughout this book, though, that leave me just kind of wondering and hoping for, like, another taste of something. And that's a really broad way of putting it. But, like, for instance, I reread the end of the book over on my subway ride over, and it's such a wonderful climax that like really builds. So there's this memorable feast at the end that it made me think for a moment. Have you seen the film Babette's Feast?
Yeah, a while ago. Yeah, and my book's been compared to that in some aspects. Yeah.
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because it's an emotional feast as much as by that point, because we know so much about the characters. And so the richness of the meal is beautifully transcribed or translated through the food as well as the goings on with the characters. So, I just needed to like taste everything like really badly. So, yeah, thanks so much. I guess we skipped ahead here a bit.
No problem.
I wanted to also discuss. A couple months ago, we had a panel that I helped moderate on food and fiction at the Food Book Fair, and I remember I wanted you to get on this panel, but you couldn't make it, and then, you know, it was in Brooklyn. But anyway, you were mentioned in this panel. We were exploring. We had, you know, a few great authors. We had Sweet Bitter, Jessica Danler. Stephanie Danler and Jessica Tom of Food Whore. And we were discussing, you know, are we seeing a sort of food-focused fiction genre building? I'm curious if you were inspired by any other books along these lines or if you see that happening now in the aftermath of, I don't know, the last few years.
Wow, I think it could. I mean, this is an evolving part of culture. I mean, well, just in the last 6-7 years, and I'm just going to pick on one thing here, I've seen such a spike in craft distilleries, you know, to say nothing about like the last 15 years of craft brewing. You know, it seems difficult to live in a world that is perceptively evolving in terms of what we eat and drink. I mean, because we have to eat and drink every day. We participate in this, whether if we stick to, you know, patterns or if we are adventurous and we go out and we seek out new things. I mean, these new things will exist whether or not we participate in them.
Yeah,
and they're part of our environment. They're part of our, evolving downtown areas and warehouse districts and outlying areas. And they're seeking to use things like, well, like I just went to a distillery in Paso Robles that uses Sanier from, leftover grape juice from wine production that was going to be thrown out otherwise, and now it's being distilled and made into vodka and gin.
Cool.
I think this kind of stuff is wonderful, and I living in this world, I'm compelled to write about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because, I'm sure other people are writing about it, particularly in nonfiction, but in fiction, I mean, fiction to me is an exercise in comprehension, in empathy. We're trying to understand how other people feel, and we're trying to understand this world that we live in as it changes faster than our ability to comprehend it. And one of those aspects of evolution is our relationship to food and drink and our choices in that regard. And I personally couldn't see it any other way. In terms of contemporary fiction, I don't personally know a lot of authors who explicitly write about food, mm-hmm. or who make it a primary focus. Certainly shows up in some writing. I mean, mm-hmm. I see it in the writing of people like Amelia Gray, for example. Or like Mo Yan, like his book Pow. Yeah, mm-hmm. if you want to call that a food novel, it's pretty exciting. I guess I consider it. I put it on a list of like my top 10 favorite food books last year.
Great.
But it seems when people think of food fiction, they often have to go back a ways. They go back to, now I'm just drawing a blank. What was that extremely influential book I read in high school that changed my life?
The Catcher in the Rye.
No.
It had recipes
in it. Like Water for Chocolate. I'm sorry. Yeah, how could I forget that?
Cool.
I also perceive it in the writings of people who don't necessarily concentrate on food. People mm-hmm. like Ben Catcher. He's a graphic novelist, lives in Brooklyn. I absolutely love his work. I'd say a good quarter of it takes place in some aspect of food community. He used mm-hmm. to run a strip called Hotel and Farm, which was often quite explicitly about restaurants and restaurant practices. And I absolutely loved his examination of both the urban and rural food experience and how people experience it on the street.
Hmm.
And that was influential on me for sure. I feel like I'd like to get to know more people who are actively writing about food as a primary focus in their fiction.
Well, thanks so much for sharing some of your inspirations and your interest in this genre. I hope that I'm definitely interested in checking some of those out.
Sure.
We're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, though, and be right back, Jen Moore.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, we're back chatting with author J. Ryan Straddle, whose first book is called The Kitchens of the Great Midwest. Thanks so much for joining us on your tour of this book. So we were just talking about some inspirations, some inspiring, books around food and, I guess, literature, fiction on this topic. And, one question I asked that panel that I would love to ask you, if let's just pretend we're there back in time.
Okay.
But, you know, are there any literary moments that really jump out in your memory for the depiction of food that was just so telling of a certain character or a certain, like, situation in the book?
Oh, wow. That's such a great question. well, yeah, I... You know, I keep thinking of nonfiction. I keep thinking of, like, you know, M.F.K. Fisher and, and stuff like that. Yeah, but I really want to think of a fiction example, so I may have to table it and sort of have that in the back of my mind, so I don't, you know, take up too much blackberry time
No problem.
Wow, that's such a great question.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot you can say through food, obviously, as you've shown in your book. Yeah, actually, let's talk more about that. You mentioned, you know, you really want to explore class and food. And I'm curious, you know, what you think about the current state of the, you know, restaurant industry or the food industry as you see it right now. You know, a lot of the, I think the buzz around food and when we talk about food is you know, high-end restaurant. There's sort of a luxury. And that's nothing new. I hope that's changing, actually, a bit. But is that something that you wanted to explore in this book, showing the, you know, the contrast between high and low?
Yeah, and I do sort of explore it in the bars chapter in terms of one character's alienation with, I think, some of the more extreme expressions of the world or what she considers to be extreme and beyond the realm of her, you know, comprehension. I think at times, just like with any movement, there are aspects of it that can seem alienating to outsiders.
Yeah.
And I think we have to be careful to not make healthy eating alienating.
One thing I was thinking about in that chapter was, you know, in today's really fast-moving food culture, everyone's, like, picking up the latest trend and trying to, you know, translate their favorite restaurant or chef-made dishes in their own kitchens and so forth. Was that Pat, in that chapter, like, said she's been making the same bars for 25 years. And I love that, you know, that idea of passing and really honing this classic in your kitchen and not really messing with it and making it yours and, you know, not moving on to the latest Chipotle bar or something like that. Crazy little, you know, yuzu grapefruit something or other.
Right.
No, but like the same.
Cherimoya rind.
Right. And that's how we create these.
Pith, I guess I should say pith. Yeah, chamoy pith sounds more realistic. But I grew up in a house where, my grandmother back in Minnesota still makes these same recipes, including some of the ones I pulled. You know, it was her book I used as a starting point for the recipes that are written about in Pat's chapter and in the Ludafus chapter, like the chicken wild rice casserole. And I think there was some discussion over whether to call it a hot dish. with a nod towards, you know, the regionalism of that phrase, and ultimately I acquiesced and called it a casserole. Even though it sounds funny for me to think about chicken wild rice casserole. Oh boy, that sounds weird. It sounds weird to say. But I love it, and I'm glad that some of these recipes can survive, even if. It might seem kind of strange or even gross by today's standards, and certainly I, at the top of our conversation, I referred to, you know, some of the standards, you know, some of the traditional Midwestern dishes,
you know,
kind of a novelty and kind of, you know, bizarre by today's standards in terms of what they were attempting to do. And certainly, you know, having been born in 1975, what I would consider to be the apex of the better living through chemistry era, I think there's a lot to improve upon. You know, when you look at recipes from that era in terms of where we were at and our comprehension of physiology and as it relates to our diet and And also we were evolving from, we're still heavily evolving in that region from being an agrarian culture to being an urban, you know, more sedentary culture. And so the idea of having a 4,000 calorie lunch, you know, wasn't that scary if you were going to go out and work in the fields for 6 hours. And certainly, you know, perhaps the idea of having a, you know, two huge slabs of chicken and wild rice casserole for lunch, and then you sit down at a desk for the next 6 hours is,
oops,
you know,
yeah,
exactly, yeah, a little more problematic. So 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 I think these things will evolve, and perhaps we'll see some healthier variations on a theme. Yeah, but you know, they're comfort food to many people my age. I've been invited to, haven't been able to attend hot dish parties in Los Angeles where people will unironically make these dishes.
I would love to check that out. Actually, this is like a side, totally unrelated question, but I'm aware that, you know, in the certain parts of the Midwest and also particularly Minnesota, there is like a dessert salad trend, like so like cookie salad and like and typically things that are cold are just called a salad, even if they're not vegetable based.
Yeah, I know. I think I've had to define it as such in the past. And any admixture of food served cold is a salad. It may or may not contain vegetables at all. That quaint and circumscribed notion of the word salad, you know, is a modern invention by Midwestern standards. Yeah, no, quite often I was given salads as a kid that combinations of meat and dairy, served cold. Or marshmallows and nuts and canned fruit cocktail and coconut, like shaved coconut and
maybe
raisins. Yeah, all kinds of. Yeah.
Maybe we'll hear about this in the next book, actually. Hopefully.
Yeah, I think at least one of them does get brought up. And another thing I bring up in the next book that gets short shrift in a book called Kitchens of the Great Midwest is rhubarb. It just didn't work out in terms of the timing.
Wait, what about rhubarb?
Kitchens takes place mostly in the late summer and early fall, which is certainly not rhubarb season. So. I took advantage of some of the months in which narrative falls in my next book to spend a little time with rhubarb.
Cool.
and give it a fair shake.
We're loving rhubarb right now. It's the season for it. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's coming to its own. And that's what I remember about Minnesota in the late spring was rhubarb.
Oh, cool.
We'd get rhubarb. And sometimes if you're bold, straight up, but usually cut with something sweet. And I remember as a kid sometimes being given, hopefully at least one of your listeners remembers something like this too, so I know I'm not crazy, but like a baggie full of sugar with sticks of rhubarb to dip in it, kind of like a Lick-O-Maid, you know, and that was our snack, you know, in second grade. We're like, little baggies of sugar with rhubarb sticks to dip them into.
That sounds great. That does sound like those little, like, I don't know, those little, like, candies. But I did, you know, put out a call for rhubarb suggestions, and somebody did suggest recently to me just sticking it in sugar and eating it raw, which was totally new to me. But I got to try that, actually. Tell us, could you share a little sneak peek into your next book and when it's coming out?
What I can say about it right now, right now I have 7 people reading the first draft, so I think it'll change a lot. I'm hesitant to say too much out of fear that I'll be completely wrong.
So you're done with
a year
the first
from now,
draft?
But
congrats.
I think what will probably stay the same, or what I set out to do, was tell a multi-generational family epic set in the Midwest, or
wonderful.
Small epic, like a muted saga of a working-class family in southern Minnesota over 4 generations.
Sounds wonderful.
I tackle a lot of things there that I wasn't able to get to in as much depth in Kitchens. I sort of felt like I'd left a lot of stones unturned in writing Kitchens, and I had a lot more to say about the region I grew up in and the people I grew up around. And I absolutely love them. I think you had mentioned earlier that someone had quoted this book as being a love letter to the food of the Midwest, and that's what it feels like to me. That's what I set out to do, and I'm not done expressing my adoration for the culture and people of my homeland.
That's terrific. Will we see any of the same characters? Maybe make a cameo?
Right now, Pat Prager is a minor character in the second book. As of right now, her mother and her niece and nephew are primary characters. So, we'll see if that changes.
Oh, that's great.
The spine of the book, as it's written now, is Pat Prager's family.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's a lot
she
more.
Was a and she was a character that, as I was writing her, I thought, I can keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I could write about her all day. And so I listened to that inclination when I sat down to write this book. Like, who are the kind of people I want to write about? And how do I want to write about them? And so it's kind of a continuation of the tone of the Pat Prager chapter in a lot of ways.
That's very cool. Really looking forward to that. I guess that's about all the time we have for today, but I can't wait to stick my teeth into the next chapter, or novel, I guess I should say. And really, thank you so much, Jay Ryan, for taking the time out of your busy day to speak with us.
Sure. Yeah. And once again, yeah, to finally answer your old question, I'd say the one thing that really stands out to me in terms of food writing
and
fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, was a piece of Ben Catcher's. I've got to refer to him again.
Okay.
Called The Breakfast Special,
uh-huh.
where he has characters puzzle over how can a breakfast special in New York cost $1.29? Yeah. And his characters kind of muse forensically on how a breakfast special can be so cheap in a city like that.
It's a really good question. Excellent.
Yeah, and I absolutely loved it. Yeah. But in any case, I'll have to stop there. So I'm sorry.
Okay.
But I just had to get that in.
No, absolutely. Definitely. We'll have to check that out. Ben Catcher. And all right, everyone. Hopefully you can check out Kitchens of the Great Midwest, now out in paperback from Viking. And thank you again, Jay Ryan. And
hey, you're welcome.
Hey, thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.